pictures and there were no figures.
Some experts say it's not all about reopening, and there are many challenges left on the way of higher education in Afghanistan.
A huge number of our scholars, professors and lecturers left our country during the government change. This has caused a significant loss in our higher education institutions. We need them back now. Furthermore, the Taliban government are going to make changes in universities' educational syllabuses and staff. It's uncertain where the Taliban are leading our higher education.
Like most public universities, Kabul University had closed in the immediate aftermath of the Taliban took over. Formerly, the university had remained shut for some months due to COVID-19 pandemic. The reopening of universities have brought hope to the younger generation in Afghanistan. The students here say this process must be supported in advance so that they can continue their education this year successfully. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iran's parliament is reviewing the details of the budget bill for the next fiscal year, starting on March 21st. The government's proposed budget stands at roughly $148 billion, some 4% higher than last year's approved budget. Lawmakers have earlier approved the generalities of the budget bill, and it's been a week now since the thorough examination of the bill kicked off in parliament's open sessions.
The government's cap on next year's budget is roughly $148 billion. Out of this figure, $60 billion is allocated for the general budget and $88 billion is earmarked for government spending. Parliament is making some revisions, especially in national development projects and infrastructure. We increased the allocated budget in these areas.
This time, the budget's examination process took longer due to the fact that lawmakers want to be as meticulous as possible while evaluating the income and spending in the country.
While Iran and the P4 Plus One are engaged in tough negotiations in Vienna over the revival of the 2015 deal, President Ebrahim Raisi says the budget bill seeks to promote a resistance economy that would not need to wait for the removal of U.S. sanctions.
Parliament says the budget bill was drawn up based on a no-deal possibility in the Vienna talks and the continuation of U.S. sanctions on Iran.
The proposed budget expects the country's oil sales to reach 1.2 million barrels per day, with $60 a barrel, which would earn Iran some $14 billion in the fiscal year 2022-23. Lawmakers reset this figure to 1.4 million BPDs, with $70 a barrel. Any agreement in the ongoing Vienna talks will immediately push Iran's oil sales up by at least 500,000 BPDs as a result of the removal of U.S. oil embargoes on Iran. But lawmakers say they will not wait for the fate of the negotiations to finalize the budget bill, saying any extra petrodollar will be spent for the good of the people.
We cannot waste our time and wait if the U.S. removes the sanctions or not. So we set the budget based on a daily export of 1.4 million barrels of oil through direct or barter sales and based on assumptions that oil prices will hover around $70 when in fact the prices are reaching $100. Any extra oil income will be saved in a national development fund.
President Ebrahim Raisi submitted the budget bill to Parliament in mid-December last year when Parliament approved its general outlines. Lawmakers now have 3 weeks to go over the details and fix the shortcomings of the budget, to pass it into law, before handing it to the higher legislative body, the Constitutional Council, for final approval. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
EU foreign affairs ministers held talks in Brussels to bolster the 27-nation bloc's second round of new sanctions against Russia over the Kremlin's military campaign in Ukraine.
Only leaders in the world who are sanctioned by the European Union, Assad from Syria, Lukashenko from Belarus, and now Putin from Russia.
Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has also been added to the sanctions list. The idea is to block banks in the EU from making funds available to the two key Russian figures. Earlier on Friday, EU leaders agreed sanctions on Russia's energy, aviation and financial sectors.
We're now targeting 70% of the Russian banking market, but also key state-owned companies, including the field of defence.
Outside the EU Leaders' Summit, union members staged a peace demonstration.
We don't think to have a war in Ukraine is a good thing for European workers and for Ukrainian workers. So we don't agree with the war.
Leaders from the 30-country NATO alliance held a summit on Friday. The big question is, could moves by the West stoke the flames and turn this crisis into a catastrophe?
NATO allies have and continue to provide support, military, but also different types of equipment to Ukraine.
US troops under the NATO flag have just arrived in Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania. Moscow had requested less provocation from NATO, but it appears those calls continue to fall on deaf ears. According to some analysts, one positive fallout from the crisis could be greater independence for the EU when it comes to foreign policy. The point has been made, there will be a realisation in the coming months. It is dangerous and extremely costly economically to allow Washington dictate relations between neighbours on the other side of the Atlantic. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
At tea break, young girls working at the Central Market in the heart of New Delhi. They say things have changed significantly since the December 2012 gang rape. Now the streets of Delhi are safer for women, as we can see the change. But more needs to be done, considering the population of the city. These working girls are excited to see the new pink booth launched by the Delhi police to make the city safer for girls and women.
Women are more secure nowadays. Police helpline number we are given, and I think last week they have opened several police booth, pink police booth in local market near places where we can directly complain women have.
Although the initiative started a week ago, the drive is gaining a gradual popularity across the city. The booths are staffed with all women police officers filing complaints on the spot, mainly in the crowded markets, besides helping female commuters with any sort of problems they face while shopping. The initiative has received an overwhelming response from citizens, especially on the social media. Now calls are growing across the country for similar booths for women and girls in distress, since the office provides them with the on-spot help. Indian women live in a constant barrage of threats ranging from rape, torture, abduction, stalking, domestic violence, dowry deaths and other forms of violence. The administration in recent years adopted a string of stringent measures as a result of large-scale reporting of crime against women. Experts say while violence against women in India is a deep-rooted social problem, there is a need for cultural change. Many are hopeful things are changing in a good direction. With a drive like the Pink Booth, women will get more sense of safety and security.
This is an iconic spot, India Gate. Here people from across the country and from abroad come to visit. We provide women and girls with all help and support. In case they face any troubles, their complaints are filled on spot rather than going to the police station.
New Delhi, which the media usually dubs one of the most unsafe cities for women, has seen a 21% rise in crime against women compared to the last year. Based on the city police, the rise is the result of a conscious policy of fear and truthful registration of complaints. Now, with the pink booth arrival at bustling markets, the Delhi police is confident to provide a safe complaint mechanism, besides hoping for it to be a success story. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
As missiles fell on Ukrainian cities, so did international condemnation rain down on Russia's attack on Ukraine. NATO's Secretary General reiterated the alliance's support of Ukraine.
We condemn Russia's aggressions in the strongest possible terms and call on Russia to immediately cease its military action.
A day earlier, EU leaders discussed developments the scale of which none of them would entirely have foreseen.
From their national capitals, leader after leader promised a coordinated and unprecedented sanctions response aimed at President Putin, the Russian elite, and the sources and havens of Russian wealth, the City of London being one of them.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson set diplomatic niceties aside, describing Vladimir Putin as a dictator, before outlining a raft of punitive measures.
We'll be imposing asset freezes on more than 100 new entities and individuals, on top of the hundreds that we've already announced. This includes all the major manufacturers that support Putin's war machine. Furthermore, We are also banning Aeroflot from the UK.
Economic warfare at the expense of negotiation as a means of ending the Ukraine crisis.
Present government or the present arrangement in Ukraine was installed in 2014, 8 years ago. So there's been 8 years of diplomacy, 8 years of opportunities to fix these very serious problems of the national question in Ukraine and of Russian national security. And the only reason we haven't seen those happening is because of the total intransigence of the US and its allies in London, in Berlin, and in Kiev.
And while the West blames Russia for triggering the crisis, others such as Iran and China say the reason behind it should be sought elsewhere.
The US administration, the German administration, had assured, given assurances to the Soviets back in 1989, back in 1990, when the two sides were renegotiating the reunification of Germany, that NATO would not expand. You know, the famous quote is, NATO will not expand even 1 inch eastwards of Germany. 30 years later, 14 countries in Eastern and Central Europe have been incorporated into NATO, including countries like Estonia, which share a border with Russia.
The war in Ukraine is ongoing. NATO member Poland says it has opened 9 reception points along Ukraine's border to receive an expected wave of refugees. Another outcome of US-led NATO's adventurism. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The Omicron variant exploded in South Korea this week, with new daily cases increasing 50% to 170,000 per day.
South Korea's surge in the Omicron variant of COVID-19 comes as other countries with declining cases relax lockdown measures. So despite the increase in new cases of the Omicron variant here in South Korea, the government's under increasing pressure to end social distancing restrictions and open up social and economic activity.
Small business people suffering from limits in hours and capacity have rallied for an end to the restrictions. The school year begins next week. Many believe classes should go ahead in person.
Insisting on virtual classes is not realistic because we don't know when the COVID-19 pandemic will end. So the government's decision looks reasonable to me, as long as there are proper measures like vaccines for the children to minimize the risk.
Some parents' group protested against vaccine mandates for teenagers amid reports of a handful of deaths attributed to vaccinations. Doctors maintain the public health benefits of getting the jab, including resuming in-person classes at school.
For students, offline, in-person class is very important, especially for the youngest. But the danger of infection is still there, and a child's infection leads to the whole family's infection. So it's better to start with offline classes until enough of the 5 to 11-year-old age group has been vaccinated.
South Korea's medical authorities this week approved the Pfizer vaccine for young children. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In what seems to be a hefty catch, the Lebanese internal security forces have thwarted a plan by Daesh terrorists to carry out 3 suicide bombings targeting religious compounds in Beirut's southern suburbs. Interior Minister Bassam al-Maulawi told reporters that had this terrorist plot not been stopped, it would have taken Lebanon to a very dangerous situation.
A Takfiri terrorist group recruited young Palestinian men in Lebanon to carry out major bombing attacks using explosive belts and using explosives which contain rocket missiles.
Lebanon's internal security forces said the instructions for the bomb plot came from a Daesh operative based in the Palestinian refugee camp of Ain al-Halwi, who is in touch with extremists in Syria. The terrorist operative was given explosive vests and other weapons to prepare for simultaneous attacks on 3 religious compounds in the southern suburbs of Beirut. This is reminiscent to a wave of attacks in the Beirut suburbs between 2013 and 2014. The instructions were passed to an undercover Internal Security Forces agent who had successfully managed to infiltrate Daesh networks in Lebanon. Observers see that Daesh has lost initiative in Lebanon, Syria and Iraq and is trying to gain ground.
I think that ISIS is now trying to implement a qualitative operation attack in Lebanon after the death of his leader al-Qurashi in 3 February in Syria, because he lost initiative in Lebanon, in Syria, and in Iraq.
Daesh is seemingly taking advantage of a deep financial crisis in Lebanon to attract recruits, promising them high salaries.
ISIS didn't stop trying to get inside the Lebanese society when he succeeded in to send many young men from Tripoli to Iraq. More than 49 young men have been sent to Iraq. 9 of them have been killed, targeted by the Iraqis just 3 weeks ago. And now the information about a Palestinian cell in the Palestinian camp in Lebanon.
Al-Mawlawi uncovered that the ministry and the security apparatus are monitoring the movement of Lebanese leaving the northern city of Tripoli to join the terrorist group and have opened talks with Iraqi authorities on this threat. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O a law. Decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshiping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to the Spotlight. On the fifth day of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, the delegations from both countries met for talks amid high hopes but low expectations for a diplomatic breakthrough. The representatives of both countries are now back in their capitals for consultations, while a UN General Assembly has also held an emergency session. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will discuss the recent developments and prospects for peace. But before that, let's get an update from our very own Jerome Hughes from Brussels. Jerome, tell us what's new.
Yes, well, Gisa, you know, this is spilling out to so many different elements. You have the sporting world responding to the crisis. You have a ban on Russian media outlets, which is another element to it. The aviation industry, all Russian aircraft cannot fly over the EU, land or take off. You have the SWIFT system, so the financial sanctions against Russia. A number of banks have been taken out of the SWIFT transaction system, which is quite damaging economically, and also targeting. There has been targeting of the Russian central bank. Of course, then you have we're hearing about the so-called refugee crisis. Of course, if we were talking about people coming from other parts of the world, there would be migrants, but the refugees, if they're coming from Ukraine. And, of course, terrible hardship for the people of Ukraine. It's not to underestimate that, but it's just the language that's being used by the EU is so different, which is interesting. And, of course, a key thing here is you have the 500 million euro, which was announced on Sunday yesterday by the European Union to finance the military in Ukraine, which is a very serious development indeed. We heard today, Monday, that a lot of that will be spent on anti-tank weapons, but also there will be, you know, fighter jets used, sent to Ukraine as well. So it's quite a worrying development. But the big thing I wanted to mention as well is about tomorrow, because I think we're going to get a bit more nuance from the EU tomorrow, because we have a full day in the European Parliament of debates on all of the issues that I've mentioned and others. I mean, I'm only tapping into a few of the issues there. But EU lawmakers will meet. They will vote on a number of the measures that have been taken or the proposals put forward by the European Commission and agreed by the EU leaders. They will vote on those proposals, and we will hear debates on the issues that I've mentioned. So we're going to hear, perhaps, no doubt, because there is a sizable number of lawmakers that will be critical of how the EU has responded to this, from becoming a peace project, perhaps, to now a more military bloc of 27 countries. So I think tomorrow will be an interesting day, Tuesday.
And we'll be in touch with you for those updates. Thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, live from Brussels. But to continue our discussion, we are joined by former UN weapons inspector in Iraq and former U.S. Marine intelligence officer Scott Ritter, and also a journalist and activist and political analyst, John Bosnich.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen. Let's begin with Mr. Ritter. Now, why did diplomacy fail to prevent the war in Ukraine in the first place? And with the current stance of the EU and NATO, is there any hope that it ever will?
Well, diplomacy was, there was no serious diplomacy. Diplomacy is a two-way street. And people tend to say that, you know, Russia is to blame because in December of last year, Russia put forward very extreme demands. Maximalist positions, and people said that's no way to enter a diplomatic dialogue. But people don't understand history. That wasn't Russia's entree into diplomacy. That was Russia's final statement after 15 years of being ignored by the West. You know, this isn't the first time we've heard about Russia's concerns when it comes to Ukraine and NATO membership. Vladimir Putin very famously warned about it in his Munich his speech before the Munich Security Council in 2007, and in 2008 or 9, following the 2008 Budapest Convention, where they invited NATO invited Ukraine and Georgia to join. William Burns, who currently is the CIA director, but back then was the U.S. ambassador to Moscow, wrote a memorandum where he outlined in great detail and accuracy Russia's concerns, and he said, "We need to pay attention to this." Well, Burns was ignored, Putin was ignored, Russia was ignored, and diplomacy was never given a chance. NATO continued to expand, NATO continued to treat Ukraine as an ally and as a proxy force. You know, Russia wasn't worried so much about Article 5 protections because Ukraine wasn't a member of NATO and didn't fall under the collective defense umbrella. They were worried about Article 4 because NATO, having designated Ukraine as an ally, could now create conditions in which NATO military power could be projected into Ukraine under Article 4. And it's not a joke. All of NATO's offensive military operations over history have been conducted in accordance with Article 4. The attack on Belgrade in 1999, the intervention in Libya in 2011, the intervention in Afghanistan in 2001. These were all Article 4 operations, and Russia had every right to be concerned that the way things were going, even if NATO said, well, Ukraine will never be a member. Ukraine was a proxy member. So diplomacy was never given a chance. And frankly speaking, at this stage, I think the division between Ukraine's position, which is Russia has to leave all abandoned troops, abandoned Crimea, and Russia's position, which is basically the Zelensky government has to denazify and forever forswear NATO membership, the distance is too far to be bridged at this point.
Thank you very much. So let's bring in our next guest here, Mr. John Bosnich. Considering everything that was said, what are the prospects of Russia getting what it wants, stopping NATO's eastward expansion?
Well, this is a long-term struggle that began almost exactly at the time that President Putin first came to office in Russia. So given the fact that Russia has resisted, first of all, has resisted the eastward push by NATO in every possible peaceful manner that anybody could have come up with until this point, we realize that finally what President Putin indicated to be the red line for the security and protection of the people of Russia had been crossed. He warned them at the time, and he has been perhaps the most patient leader in modern history. This time they've gone one bridge too far.
Well, thank you very much. Now, back to Mr. Ritter. Now, Scott, I'm not sure if you were listening to Jerome Hughes, our correspondent, who gave us an update just before we started speaking. But he gave us a complete list of the sanctions imposed by the EU on Russia. The question is, how effective can these sanctions be?
Well, we'll find out. I mean, the important thing to note here is that these sanctions have been threatened for some time. And while the details weren't specified, economic strategists in Moscow should have been able to predict the range of options available to the West to sanction Russia and come up with, solutions to these problems before invading. I think everybody should have been able to foresee that once Russia crossed the border into Ukraine, the promised sanctions were going to be unleashed. Now the proof is in the pudding. Is Russia, as many people have said, truly sanction proof, or has the West finally found the right mix of sanctions capable of paralyzing the Russian economy to the point that it can actually compel a change in policy on the part of Vladimir Putin's government? My betting, if I were to bet, is that Russia has predicted these sanctions and has solutions. Solutions will be painful, but the sanctions will not in and of themselves cause any deviation from the direction that Russia is heading.
So, Mr. Bosnich, do you agree? Because I saw that you were also nodding.
Well, I can say from my own experience as a war reporter in the former Yugoslavia across all of the period from the beginning of the fighting until the final ending of fighting in Kosovo and so on, that sanctions simply do not work. They generally tend to support the government that's in power, raise the public anger with the external forces that are sanctioning them, and generally fail. And after sanctions, then there's attempted military regime change and so on. But sanctions are basically a ploy to convince the American public that they tried everything peaceful before they go to war. So sanctions are a kind of a softener for the knockout punch, which is always planned in advance, and that is the actual taking a military action abroad. That is the core engine of the U.S. economy. They're not turning it off.
Well, thank you very much. Now, back to Scott. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said in a recent tweet that his country has been left alone by the U.S. and the EU. Why did they abandon Ukraine, or why is Zelensky under the impression that he has been abandoned?
I'm somewhat sympathetic to the Ukrainian president in that the United States, NATO, Europe has been dangling the promise of NATO membership before Ukraine. And Ukraine, acting on this promise, has gone all in terms of doing the bidding of the U.S. and NATO when it comes to Russia. Unfortunately, Zelensky and the Ukrainian government didn't realize until too late that they had simply been a tool of provocation, that they were sacrificed by a Western power structure that needed Russia to do something dramatic, like militarily intervene in Ukraine, so that there could be a final solution to the Russian problem. And that's how the West sees this. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has allowed NATO to become revitalized, has created a sense of unity in Europe, has joined the United States and NATO and Europe together in a way that was unimaginable back in August of last year when the debacle in Afghanistan was unfolding. NATO was disgraced, America was embarrassed, and Europe was divided. Now everybody is coming together, and they think they have a solution to the Russian problem through the vehicle of economic sanctions. I think they're all wrong, but that's beside the point to your question. Zelensky was betrayed. Zelensky was led to believe that he would have the backing of the world, but the world only comes to his assistance now after the fact, after his nation has been violated, after his people are being killed, and after his government has been put on the chopping block. I don't think this ends with Zelensky still in power.
Thank you very much. Now, back to Mr. Bosnich. Now, British author John Laughlin has said, and I'm quoting him, "It is better to be an enemy of Americans than their friend. If you are their enemy, they might try to buy you, but if you are their friend, they will definitely sell you." Now, do you think that President Zelensky has realized this bitter truth?
Well, I think he has. I strongly agree with my colleague's comment. This is a general fact, but unfortunately, it's a fact learned usually by at least one betrayal, and so there is a kind of, and it happened all across Eastern Europe. There was a kind of euphoria of escape from communism and so on, and the end upshot of the deal was that America actually selected the future governments of the new regimes in Eastern Europe, which are almost all hand-picked and put in power by American campaign organizers and so on. So we've got a new kind of colony growing. And this is all the kind of thing that was taking place in Ukraine. And I do remember that we had one Georgian president who was a pro-American CIA-supported president who was run out of Georgia, and then he was appointed a governor in Ukraine. Well, it's standard policy for the CIA to rotate its agents from one field of operations to another. That was the most blatant sign that the CIA was calling all the shots in Ukraine. And remember this, when you talk about the comedian president of Ukraine, Zelensky, a comedian is something before anything else, and that is a good actor. He probably knew there was no chance, but was given the orders to do what has happened, to see if Russia would respond or not. Now that Russia has responded, somebody in Washington is staying up late trying to figure out what to do.
Thank you very much. Now, back to Scott. Let's zoom out a bit and look at this from a world viewpoint. There's a lot of focus right now on the conflict in Ukraine. Everyone's talking about it. Any news channel you turn to was talking about Ukraine. But we never saw this when the U.S. and NATO invaded Iraq and Afghanistan. Also now in Yemen, we really don't see that much news coming out from Yemen, whereas it has been labeled a textbook example of a humanitarian disaster by the United Nations itself. Why do you think it is so?
Well, there's two things at play here. One, we'll just be right up front, it's blatant racism. I don't mean to be offending to anybody who's watching this, but if your skin isn't lily white, your eyes aren't blue, your hair isn't blonde, we don't care about you, not in the West. We'll bomb you, we'll kill you, we'll remove you from your homes. We'll mourn you when it's politically necessary. For instance, if we want to put all the blame on the suffering of the people of Yemen on the shoulders of Iran, we'll cry for the people of Yemen. But it's crocodile tears. It's not real. So there's racism here. Two, the struggles that are taking place in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, and elsewhere are ancillary to a larger geopolitical picture. They're not game changers, meaning that no matter what happens in Yemen, the world will still be the same. What differentiates Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, and other conflicts of this sort from Ukraine is that Ukraine is a game changer. I mean, this is a conflict being waged to change, fundamentally change, the European security framework, and by extension, to challenge the unilateral status held, you know, the power status held by the United States, the so-called rules-based international order. Russia is challenging this with force. If Russia prevails, Europe will not look the same. And it's not just that Europe won't look the same, Asia won't look the same, the world won't look the same, because instead of a unilateral superpower called the United States, there will be multiple polarities of power. It's a world-changing event, and this is why I think you see the West paying attention. They highlight the humanitarian aspect because, I mean, we've heard it over and over again at the train station in Poland. White people get on the train, dark people don't. So, you know, the humanitarian aspect is magnified because white people are played. But beyond, the, you know, the that aspect of it, This is a global game changer. If Russia prevails in what it's doing in Ukraine and successfully challenges NATO, the NATO security structure that is governed in Europe, you know, since the end of the Cold War, you know, this will resonate. China will now feel emboldened vis-a-vis Taiwan in the South China Sea. And you might see other nations start to shake off the mantle of post-colonialism. So I think that's why Ukraine is getting the attention, because it's woken a lot of people in the West up about, oh, my goodness, you know, the rules-based order is being challenged and perhaps successfully challenged.
And Mr. Bosnich, if anything, for the rest of the world watching this, these recent developments have brought to light the issue of a bad war and a good war. Not only can we see this in the coverage of the news, but also the international response to the conflict. We see countries rushing to help Ukraine. We never saw that in other parts of the world. So could this at least trigger a more balanced approach now that we're talking about it, now that we're bringing it to light? Do you think that public opinion could change?
It's going to be a far longer battle to change the brainwashed minds of many of the viewers of the lying mainstream media. I'm sorry to call it, but that's what it is in the West. I worked there for years, and I can tell you that it is exactly as it is. And every day for me was a battle there to try and get out a truthful article. I can tell you that this is going to have a long-term resonance that will prove to the United States, especially, and to London, which usually trains the future leaders of the United States in their elite school system, it will prove to them that this very short day of the Anglo-American Empire is ending. And it's time to recognize that in the interest of survival, not just their own, but of everyone. They created this war driven by aggression. They have hundreds and hundreds of bases around the planet. They have started almost 80 wars since World War II, what they call military interventions. And now when Russia takes a similar act after years, 7.5 years of putting up with ethnically based genocidal attacks, that Russia finally takes a very, very limited action in terms of deaths. We say several hundred are reported dead now. Instead of an invasion, decide to destroy Ukraine. This will turn the tide. And it is a lesson for China, and it is a lesson also, too, for even India. These are lessons for the major powers, and Iran, as a power that has been threatened by the United States, must take very careful note of what's going on here.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. John Bosnich, journalist and activist and political analyst out of Belgrade, and also Mr. Scott Ritter, former U.N. weapons inspector in Iraq and former U.S. Marine intelligence officer out of Bethlehem, New York. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts with us. That's all the time that we have on this edition of The Spotlight. And thanks to all of you for following this edition.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند
و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد میشید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we had a survey of Imam Khomeini's testament in a number of episodes, and last episode, you heard the concluding part of the testament. Today, you're going to hear his marriage with Lady Khadija Saghafi. Stay tuned for more. Lady Khadija Saghafi was Imam Khomeini's wife. She was a virtuous lady while she was well aware of social and political developments of her time. A brief glance at her marital life shows that she was a very patient woman, as she had to accompany the greatest contemporary personality, Imam Khomeini, who successfully changed the course of history against the will of oppressors and tyrants. Miss Saghafi was the lady who tolerated the hard times of Imam Khomeini's arrest, several months separation, his life in exile in Turkey and then Iraq under tough conditions. This great lady was undoubtedly a major factor in all phases of the Imam's struggles and successes. Khadija Saghafi, also known as Qudsi and Quds-e-Iran, was born in 1914 in a religious family. Her father, Ayatollah Mirza Muhammad Saghafi, was one of the great ulema in Tehran, whose ancestors were clergymen for generations. Her mother, however, was from a well-to-do family. Hence, Khadija grew up with no financial problem. Young Khadija lived 15 years with her grandmother, who had no child. Yet, the wealthy life didn't prevent her from acquiring ethical merits. She was a hard-working girl, and she spent her elementary school and part of her high school to learn French. This enthusiasm for knowledge continued through her marital life, even when she gave birth to her fourth child. Lady Khadija Saghafi endured all problems of migration to Qom and living in difficult conditions with Imam Khomeini, as the Imam was a pain in the neck of the Pahlavi regime. Lady Khadija Saghafi loved studying and would rarely spend her day without studying a book or a newspaper or a magazine. Recitation of the Noble Quran was also part of her daily works. She had also studied the Divan of Hafiz, Golestan of Sa'di, and many literary and historical books. She knew many poems by heart. Imam Khomeini's wife was so interested in reading books that the last years of her life she would ask others to read books for, as she could not read due to old age. Imam Khomeini was studying till the age of 26 in the holy city of Qom. He lived only with the money that received from his family in Khomein
and would never accept the stipend that the sources of emulation sent to him. Miss Khadija Saghafi was introduced to Imam Khomeini by Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad Lavasani, and the former accepted as he had an old-age friendship with Miss Saghafi's father. However, the difference of living conditions of the two families caused a wave of opposition against this marriage. Lady Khadija Saghafi writes on this, "The opposition increased. Basically, it was considered impossible that I would be the wife of a seminary student. For these reasons, my dear father explained in detail to Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Lavasani as why this proposal was impossible. My father had told him that this was very problematic. This girl would not be allowed to cope with the life of a seminary student. It is true that Mr. Ruhullah, Imam Khomeini, is very pious and God-wary, who has gained the degree of ijtihad at a young age, and he has studied philosophy and irfan, Islamic Gnosticism, regularly, and is a man of both knowledge and practice. I know Mr. Khomeini, and I know that his knowledge is more than his age, and he has a bright future. Yet, Qudsi and her grandfather consider a big number of problems. The proposal for marriage was presented several times, but each time the answer was disappointing. Finally, Lady Khadija Saghafi gave the positive answer to the marriage proposal after 9 months. The positive answer was mainly because of the three dreams that she had seen. Khadija Saghafi relates one of her dreams as follows. I saw in a dream that there was a small room in a house in which three men were sitting while I and a lady who had a special chador were sitting in the opposite room. The lady answered my questions. I asked her as who those men were. She answered, the man in the opposite is the prophet, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, who has a black turban. On his side, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, is sitting, who has a green turban, and on the other side, Imam Hassan, peace upon him, is sitting also with a black turban. I was very happy and asked, so these are my prophet and imams? She answered bitterly, but you do not accept them. As I was thumping my chest, I said angrily, what are you saying? I love them very much, and I consider myself among their ummah, and I have obeyed what they have said, and I will obey what they will say. At this time, I woke up. Thus, the ceremony of proposal for marriage was done shortly after the dream of Khadija Saghafi. Interestingly, the house of Khadija and Ruhullah was the same that she had seen in her dream. She writes, the day after the marriage, I noticed that this is the same house that I had dreamt. This is the same room where I had dreamt the prophet, the commander of the faithful, and Imam Hassan. Even the door and the window are the same which my mother had prepared for me after the dream.
Thank you. Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.